interesting things here, like starting next week. Now, we talked yesterday about why archaeology is important for the Bible student to know something about. However, I want to give one qualification, and that's this. You see, the Bible does not need to be proved to be believed. We don't have to prove the Bible. We don't have to always feel like, well, can we prove it archaeologically, or can we somehow find scientific evidence to prove the Bible? Because the Bible says that all Scripture is given by inspiration of God and is therefore profitable for doctrine and reproof and so forth. And not only that, but scientific authentication can never take the place of faith. And God has set all of Christianity up so that you must go by faith. So there are going to be many things in the Bible that you cannot prove through archaeology. For example, there's no way that you can prove that Israel crossed the Red Sea through the Red Sea by archaeology. How would you do it? You can't do it. Either you accept it by faith, or you look at it and say, well, that's got to be a myth and I can't accept it. It really boils down to faith. And the Bible says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7 that we walk by what? By scientific authentication and by archaeological exploration? No. It says in 2 Corinthians 5:7, we walk by faith. We walk by faith. So, therefore, I'm assuming that all the Bible is right, it's correct, it's flawless, it's inerrant, it has no mistakes in it, and I don't need to always have it proved before I can believe it. And then in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6, it says that without faith it is impossible to believe God, to please God, I should say. Hebrews 11:6. And so, therefore, the Bible demonstrates itself to be what it claims to be to those who will believe its message. And when you begin to believe the message of the Word of God, the Bible begins to demonstrate itself to be true. But if you don't believe the Bible, well then no amount of archaeological authentication is going to help you. The next point is that archaeology is actually a relatively new science. Relatively a new science. In fact, it really did not begin until the 1800s. Now, I'm talking primarily about Bible archaeology, but even all of archaeology really is not that old of a science. But archaeological evidence and so forth really did not come in to confirm the Bible until really the 1800s and the 19th century. One of the first archaeologists was a man called Edward Robinson in 1838. And Robinson went from America to Palestine and identified many of the sites that are mentioned in the Bible. In other words, he read about Bethlehem and he read about Jericho. And what he did, he went throughout Palestine trying to find these sites. And he did locate many of them. And then many of them were excavated later on in the following years of the 19th and 20th century. And then there was a lot of work done by a group called the Palestine Exploration Fund, which was formed in England in 1865. But the point is that archaeology was really not a widely acclaimed science until maybe 150 years ago or so. And in fact, until then, there was really very little known of ancient times outside of the Bible. There was really no source you could turn to for exhaustive information on ancient times. There were some fragments of ancient Greek and Roman writings, and there were classical Greek writings that contained references to history from about 500 BC on. But outside of that, there was not a lot of information to illustrate the Bible, especially the Old Testament. And a lot of the information that was contained by the ancient historians is inaccurate. It's not correct. It's false. And that has been proven throughout time here. I'll give you one example. The Bible indicates that Abraham went down into Egypt. When you read in the book of Genesis, the famine was in the land of Palestine. Abraham disobeyed God and he went down into Egypt. Well, that was about 2000 BC. That's when Abraham lived. But there's an ancient historian called Diodorus, and Diodorus stated that strangers were not allowed in Egypt until about 700 BC. And so he's writing, and he's an ancient historian, he's saying there weren't any strangers allowed in Egypt about 700 BC. So the question now, who is right? Is the Bible right or is Diodorus? Should we accept the testimony of this ancient historian, Diodorus, or the Bible? Well, they discovered through Egyptian archaeological monuments, they actually discovered people coming from Syria and Palestine, and they dated these monuments, and they were around 2000 BC. And so they lined up exactly with what the Bible was saying. So in other words, Diodorus was wrong, and the Bible again was proven accurate. So my point is that even though there are a few ancient historians, a lot of their information was not correct. It was wrong. In fact, if you look at like Herodotus and his drawings of the ancient world, it's just crazy. It's far-fetched because they didn't know what was beyond the Middle East. They didn't know what was beyond northern parts of Africa. And so they've got this picture, and it's a little tiny world if you've ever seen it. It's nothing like the true world really is. And in fact, just let me illustrate the fact that there's hardly any information historically by just reminding you of Adam Clark's Bible commentary. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was written during the years 1810 to 1826, a long time ago. And he cites all the available evidence from the ancient historians of his day. He spent 16 years writing that commentary, devoting his life to it. He went everywhere he could to try to find information from the ancient historians. And that is a 6-volume commentary set. And he depleted all the knowledge that he could find during that time on ancient history. So it's very fragmentary and incomplete knowledge that we have about ancient times before archaeology began, see? So that's why archaeology has been a real valuable science today. In fact, let me write down for you 4 of the main ancient historians that shed any amount of light on the Bible. There are 4 of them, and these are about the main historians that help us to understand Bible events. And this is about it. Now, there are some others. Now, when I talk about historians, I'm talking about ancient historians, like, 300, 400 B.C. before Christ. One of them, number one, would be a man called Herodotus, who was a Greek. Herodotus. That's spelled H-E-R-O-D-O-T-U-S. He's called the father of history. The father of history, because he took a fair amount of time to write down ancient history and to investigate it. In fact, he was actually a widely traveled Greek, spent a lot of his time traveling around, looking and investigating various things. He traveled all the way down to Egypt and looked at the pyramids and wrote descriptions of them. He traveled over to Babylon and wrote some things about Babylon, and that's 420 BC. He did record the Persian assault on Greece, which is interesting because the Bible talks about the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire, and it does talk about Greece defeating Persia and so forth. And he also wrote 2 or 3 books on Babylon, Egypt, and the Middle East. So we do have him. Then there's a second one. His name is Berossus, another ancient historian, Berossus. And that's spelled B-E-R-O-S-U-S, Berossus. And Berossus lived between the years 330 to 250 B.C. 330 to 250 B.C., he was a Babylonian priest. So he lived in Babylon, and he wrote a history of Babylon in the Greek language. So that's been valuable, because historians have been able to look at that and to glean some information about ancient Babylon. However, it is fragmentary in nature. Parts of it have been lost, and so it's not as much information as a person could wish for. Then there's a third one. His name is Manetho. Manetho. And that's spelled M-A-N-E-T-H-O. Manetho. Manetho was an Egyptian priest, rather than a Babylonian priest, living during the same period of time as Berossus lived. And the valuable thing about Manetho is that he wrote a history of Egypt. And, of course, Egypt has a very intriguing history. So he wrote a history of Egypt from the beginning up to a king called Ptolemy II. And so he does talk about the history of Egypt, and there are some portions that remain of his writings today. The only problem with Manetho is that he has a real tendency to exaggerate, and that becomes real apparent. He talks about the pharaohs, and he believes that the pharaohs were gods that came to the earth, and many of them lived, they were 25,000 years old and 20,000 years old and so forth. And he's talking about these early rulers of Egypt, and he's writing it as though it is fact. Well, when a man writes like that and he's talking about all these men living to be 25,000 years, it kind of makes you wonder about everything else he's written about. But we do have Manetho. And then finally, there's good old Flavius Josephus. The world would be the same without Flavius. Flavius Josephus.
The Jewish turncoat.
That means traitor. He lived in the first century A.D. First century A.D. Actually, he lived from A.D. 37 to A.D. 100. A.D. 37 to A.D. 100. He was a Jewish priest, and he's actually living shortly after the time of Christ. He's living during the time of the first century church. But Flavius Josephus actually deserted the Jews and joined the Romans, and later on became secretary to the emperor Vespasian, who was a Roman emperor. So he became a very prominent Roman military. I think he was either a general or a high-ranking officer. But at any rate, he deserted the Jews, really in their hour of need, and joined the Romans. But he did write two large volumes on the history of the Jews up to his time. Two large volumes on the history of the Jews. So we do have the writings of Josephus. And you see, those are real, real valuable. In fact, you can go down to most Christian bookstores and buy a translation of his writings. He has a lot of interesting things to say about that first century Palestine, as well as all the history of the Jews. Well, let's move on to another thought. Let's look at some of the techniques that are used by the archaeologists. Yes?
Herodotus
lived? Well, he lived actually from about 484 to 420 B.C., Herodotus. And, of course, we have question marks really with some of these dates because some of them are kind of really up in the air as to if they actually lived or were born on that very day. Let's talk about some of the techniques that are used by archaeologists, just real briefly, so you can understand some of the different things that are involved in archaeology. We won't spend a lot of time on this. Normally what happens is they come to a particular site and they're interested in excavating it. Normally what they do is they survey it to establish the boundaries. And they chart the elevations and the depressions in the site in which they're going to excavate. And then what they do, they make a blueprint of the entire area. And they write all the little hills in on the blueprint and all the depressions. And so they make a blueprint of the whole location. And then what they are required to do in most of these countries is that they take this blueprint down and they must have it inspected. And it must be okayed by the authorities. You see, in Palestine, in Israel, you can't just dig anywhere, because the land is really filled with archaeological remains. And it used to be real common a number of years ago to just plunder, just start digging anywhere you wanted to dig and to unearth all these things and to go down to the local, rabbinical Jewish swap shop or whatever and to sell it for whatever money you needed. And consequently, a lot of areas were ruined, so now you have to have it inspected. And then after the blueprint is okayed, it is marked off in strips or sections with grid numbers. So there are like little squares all over this blueprint, and they are all numbered now. They have a number with each one of those grids. And then they begin the actual excavation, and when they do that, they find various artifacts, and they log them according to that grid number. They write it down in a book exactly which grid that particular artifact was found in. So therefore, you see, later on they have a record of where everything was found originally. Because obviously after you dig the place up, then you got to have some record of where it was found in the original site. Because obviously all the earth is now removed and so forth, and you can't remember exactly where everything was. So as the objects are found, there's an accurate record kept of the exact place in the earth in which it was unearthed. Now normally, the most scientific way of excavating an area is like this. Normally, they excavate what is called a mound. And it will be a large mound like this. And that mound is the site of an ancient city. And what the cities would do is that in ancient times, they originally built a city somewhere. And then conquerors came down and conquered the city. And they later on, the people that originally lived there or their ancestors came back, and they flattened everything, and they built on top of that. And then they were conquered again, and we're talking about hundreds of years passing in time now. But they just kept on building on top of the existing city like that. We're talking about hills now that are several miles, in several square miles. And the reason they kept building on the same location is because of things like water and so forth. And you couldn't just build anywhere in Palestine. And so consequently, you end up with several different layers of civilization like this that had been destroyed down through time. And this is called a tell. T-E-L-L. For example, the city of Jerusalem is built on a huge hill. And that's natural mountains, but also it's built on several feet, probably several hundred feet, of rubbish down through time. And so what they do is that each of these layers is systematically cleared, layer after layer. In other words, they take the top layer off, and then the next layer off, and then the next layer off, and they study all the artifacts of each several layer. And often they'll photograph various discoveries as they unearth them and discover them. Now, this method is called stratigraphy, this method of excavation. Stratigraphy, that's spelled S-T-R-A-T-I-G-R-A-P-H-Y, in which one layer is removed at a time, and then the various levels at which the people lived are carefully studied, and then the relationships between the artifacts are noted. And you can tell it's a real clear... Maybe I spelled that wrong. Okay, I get a B-minus today for misspelling words. Spell it like this. Yeah, that's a little bit better. Okay, so that is spelled S-T-R-A-T-I-G-R-A-P-H-Y, stratigraphy. And this is where all the levels of the strata are removed a layer at a time, and then they'll study each one of those levels of culture. And they actually number them. They start with Roman numeral 1 up at the top, and then the next layer is Roman numeral 2, and then, of course, number 3, number 4, number 5, and then number 6. And they have separate blueprints for each one of those levels so that they know where everything is. And then they are called, for example, stratum 1. Stratum Roman numeral 1, like that. And normally they can date each one of these levels pretty accurately. Normally it's pretty obvious to them, to a real trained archaeologist. This is a very, very expensive method, very time-consuming, but it is the most scientific and the most fruitful. In the early days, back in the 1800s, what they used to do is just start digging. They'd just get in there and just start digging, and the dirt would start flying, and they'd just start unearthing things. And then they realized that no one was really able to keep track of where everything came from. They had to have a lot more systematic means of digging. And incidentally, in Mesopotamia, these tells will often be a couple hundred feet tall. They're real obvious. I've got some slide pictures, time permitting, we'll look at. But they're real obvious. They stick right out, and they're very, very huge hills. And it looks just like a massive hill. There's grass growing on them and so forth. But really, they're an ancient city. Now, there's another method that they use sometimes. The first one is stratigraphy. The second one is what is called sounding. Sounding. It's like our English word sound. And what sounding is, or refers to, is just simply a shaft that is dug straight down into the hill. So they'll like just dig a shaft down like this, straight down. And they'll excavate layer after layer, and they'll go straight down like that, rather than removing layer after layer, scientifically, they just dig a shaft straight down like that and remove all the soil. And the reason they do that is because it's so expensive to strip layer after layer after layer. They don't always have the money or the time or the help to do that, so they'll just take a small area and dig a tunnel down, and they'll do what is called sounding, and they'll study each layer like that to get a sample of the whole tail. And that's real common to do that, too. In fact, what they'll often do is they'll often tunnel first, or sound first, and they'll do this first to see if it really justifies stripping layer after layer. And then after that, they'll come back and do the second method. So that's kind of interesting how they do that. And the thing about sounding is that it only gives you a general knowledge of the area. It doesn't give you a real extensive knowledge. And sometimes it is, however, used exclusively in areas in which you cannot remove all the layers. For example, like the city of Jerusalem. There's already existing people living on the top layer. So obviously you can't strip layer after layer. There's people living there, and they want their houses. They own that land. So you can't move them off. So what they do is they do a lot of sounding there in the city of Jerusalem. And right now, according to one journal that I read, there's kind of a fad in Jerusalem, and that's this. People are digging underneath their own houses because they own that house, they own that land, and they charge admission to tourists. And I saw pictures of people that they had dug, you know, like 30 or 40 feet below their house. They had it all braced up with different, you know, timbers and so forth, and they had lights strung up there, and they'll take tourists down for a small fee, of course, and they'll take you down, and they're finding, anywhere you dig in Jerusalem, you're going to find pottery and coins and bones and who knows what else. You're going to find things there. And so they have found a lot of things like that. Well, then the next thought is workmen that are digging and so forth. And let me mention briefly about some of the workmen. First of all, there is what is called an area supervisor. An area supervisor. And he is supervising and directing the actual digging in his area. You might have one supervisor, or you might have several of them. And he's watching over everything. And he's carefully recording everything in what is called a field notebook, making sure that all the workmen are doing their job. Then another category would be the pickmen, who are out swinging the pick, gently, hopefully. But they are carefully breaking up the compacted soil. And then there's a group called the hoe men, and they come in with hoes, and they work over the newly loosened soil, and they're looking for anything of any significance, and they are, as it were, screening the soil. And then there's a group called the basket men, and they come in with like a wheelbarrow, or maybe a basket if they can't wheel a wheelbarrow around this area, and they will carry the dirt off after inspection. So you normally have a number of people working together like this. And of course, it used to be, up until not too long ago, you could get all this help real cheap. You could go over, and there were a lot of people that were very, very poor, and they couldn't find a job anyway, and so labor was very cheap. However, it's not quite as cheap today. And so what they do, they've kind of changed it a little bit, I notice. They have what are called archaeological vacations. And you can actually go on this vacation, and I noticed it in a magazine called Biblical Archaeological Review, and you know, you pay them $1,000, and they ship you over there, and you can enjoy what is called a dig. And it's like 110 or 115 degrees outside, maybe in the shade there, and you can spend your two-week vacation digging in the soil and having fun being an archaeologist. And of course, you know who does all the work. You do all the work, plus you pay to go there, plus you come back home with a bunch of Bengay on your back from hauling all that dirt off, and you've done them a favor. But anyway. Then next, I want to talk real briefly about dating methods, just real briefly. How do they date these various archaeological finds? How do they know how old they really are? There's a couple of different methods that they use. The first one is probably one of the most common. It's called carbon-14 dating. Carbon-14, it's also called radiocarbon dating. Carbon-14, and without getting real technical about all this, it can be rather difficult to understand and explain. Just let me say that there's what is called carbon-14, it's a certain isotope of carbon, and it's a form of carbon that degenerates into carbon-12, which is the normal form of carbon. And it has a half-life of about 5,600 years. And so let's say if you have a block of matter like this, and if it's all carbon-14, they write it like that. Let's say the whole block is all carbon-14. And if you were to come back 5,600 years later and measure it, then half of it would be carbon-14, and half of it would be carbon-12. It would be just like that. And then if you came back 5,600 years later, theoretically, this half right there, that part would be carbon-14, and this part would be carbon-12. And it just keeps on decaying all the way down, so on and so forth, all the way down into carbon-12. And so it's called carbon-14. And theoretically, by measuring the proportion of carbon-14 to carbon-12, you can theoretically determine the age of an object. But there are some weaknesses to this method of dating. I'll mention a couple briefly. One weakness is that carbon-14 is found only in organic materials, only in organic substances. And by organic, I mean something that was once living, like an animal or a human being or a plant or leather or clothing, something that is organic. Wood or cloth or bone or something like this. Those are relatively rare in Palestinian excavations. You don't find many items like that. Most of the things that you unearth are like pottery or maybe steel implements or iron, I should say, implements, or maybe something like stone, see? And you can't date any of that with carbon-14. Then another problem is that whenever you date with carbon-14, you destroy a sizable portion of the sample. You've got to burn up or you've got to destroy a certain portion of it. Most archaeologists, if they finally find something like a sandal, they don't want half of it or three-quarters of it burned up to test how old it is. See, they'll date it with other methods. And then the final problem or weakness is that carbon-14 is supposed to decay at this rate of 5,600 years, but there are a lot of scientists that really question the accuracy and the reliability of this type of dating. There's a lot of other factors that can change that date, that can change that half-life, so it's not fully been proven to be accurate yet. Well, there's another method called pottery typology that they use to date items with. Pottery typology. Writing kind of crooked there, but pottery typology. Typology, of course, is spelled T-Y-P-O-L-O-G-Y. And what this simply means is a study of different types of pottery. A study of different types of pottery. In other words, archaeologists have developed really a very detailed knowledge of different types of pottery. And this different type of pottery is characteristic of each period of time. It's kind of like dating antiques. Someone that is really good at dating antiques. They can look at antiques and they can tell by what type of varnish is used and what type of patterns are on the antique and what type of wood it's made out of and what how the drawers are dovetailed and so forth. They can tell how old the antique is. They can date it by the style of it. Well, that's what pottery is like. And they have all these categories, and I'm not going to elaborate on them, but they've got, for example, starting with the early bronze and the middle bronze and the late bronze and the Iron Age and the Persian period and the Hellenistic period and the Roman period. And when they're uncovering a certain stratum, they'll find a certain type of pottery that was characteristic of that period. And then they go down to the next level, and the pottery changes because the style changed. You know, it changes every 100 years or whatever. And the handles are different, and the colors of the vase are different, and the material it's made out of is different. And so they can date stratum then by the pottery fragments that are found in it. There's another method of dating, and that's called inscriptions. Inscriptions. An inscription is an engraving on stone, something that's written on stone or wood or metal, or maybe a clay tablet. And often, you might find a stone or an archway or something that will talk about a king. And we know historically exactly when that king ruled and when he reigned. So therefore, you can date that building, or you can date that level of strata. Or you might find coins, and those coins will have the picture of Alexander the Great stamped on them. Well, therefore, you know what period of time you're looking at. In fact, that's my next point. Another way of dating is coins, which would be characteristic of various historical periods, and minted under certain emperors. Well, one final point with archaeology, and that's this. The final point about it is that modern archaeology really began in the area called Mesopotamia. And if we look on our map, it's this area here, ancient Babylon and ancient Assyria. And it's kind of interesting how it began. It really began kind of accidentally. There were a couple of men, Paul Ema Bada and Claude James Rich and Sir Austin Henry Layard, and two of those men were Englishmen, and the other man was a Frenchman. And they were stationed here in Babylon and in Assyria, extremely dreary areas to get stationed to. I mean, it is bad. It looks like Nevada during a famine or something, Nevada during a heat stroke. It is bad in this area. There's nothing there, nothing. And so they were stationed there as like British and French ambassadors. And what they started doing in their spare time, they would go out and they would investigate all these ancient ruins. No one knew anything about them, didn't know anything about these ancient societies. And all of a sudden, they started discovering ancient city after ancient city after ancient city. and they found huge libraries with like 250,000 volumes. These are clay volumes or clay tablets in them. And of course, no one could read them. The Babylonian language was a totally dead language during that time. But nevertheless, they uncovered all these things. One of them layered uncovered a vast Assyrian king palace. And the king is even mentioned in the Bible. His name is King Sargon. And it was just a beautiful palace that he uncovered. And so it really began in Mesopotamia. That's the thing that sparked interest in archaeology, especially when they started noticing that these things were lining up with the Bible. You know, it's kind of interesting to be reading along in your Bible, and you're reading about King Sargon, and then you start digging around in these ancient ruins, and you find out this is King Sargon's palace. And you're walking around through it, and you're looking at all the pillars, and you're looking at all the carvings on the wall. And not only that, but they found, at least on in one area, an actual picture of a king of Israel, King Jehu, I think. And his picture is right there on this relief in this ancient palace. And so that really makes the Bible come alive, and that's where the interest really began. Okay, well, that's it for archaeology. From now on, we're just going to be telling you about various significant archaeological finds and how they tie in with the Bible. Are there any questions here before we move on to another thought? Yes?
Did you mention the time that started?
Yes, it began in the 1800s and the 19th century. I didn't give you the actual dates, but, for example, with Claude James Rich, who was an agent of the British East India Company, he started digging and discovering bricks around 1811, and he started digging in these ancient ruins. And then also in 1820, they found other palaces and so forth. And then in 1842, this one archaeologist discovered the Palace of Sargon, 1842. So we're looking at basically the early 1800s. And of course, they were totally untrained during that time, and no one really knew what they were doing. No one really knew how to interpret all the evidence at that time. Let's move on to another topic, and Cub Scouts promise now. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about this, so please don't feel like this is what the whole class is going to be like. We're going to be talking about basic Bible lands, and I'll probably only spend about maybe an hour and a half total on this, but really, we're not going to do this all semester. But I want to orient you as far as basic Bible lands, and let me say at the outset that if you're interested in some of the facts I'm going to be giving about these lands, then you can look in Baker's Bible Atlas. If you look in Baker's Bible Atlas, pages 14 through 22, it will give you all the very facts I'm going to mention in class today. Baker's Bible Atlas, pages 14 through 22. A lot of time, the teacher will be mentioning these facts, and the student doesn't have time to write them down, and he is interested in them and would desire to have them. Well, you can find almost everything I'm going to tell you for the next hour and a half in Baker's Bible Atlas in those particular pages. Let's talk about basic Bible lands. Next week I'll be giving you a sheet of paper, and you'll have to locate these lands on that sheet of paper, and you'll be able to take it home and work on it. So this will kind of help you get you thinking about these different boundaries and so forth. First of all, basic Bible lands, when we talk about Bible lands, is not limited to just the little land of Palestine. So when we talk about the geography of Bible lands, we're talking about ancient Persia, ancient Assyria, ancient Syria, and ancient Egypt, and so forth. So we're going to be talking about a lot more expansive land than just Palestine. But first of all, the first point is that basic Bible lands are really defined by five major bodies of water. There are five major bodies of water that define ancient Bible lands. Let me mention them for you. First of all, there is what is called the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf. And on our map, it's this body of water right here. And unfortunately, these maps really are not large enough. You can't see the full extension of them. But if you were to look at this map fully drawn, this would be the Arabian Peninsula, which is kind of like a triangle. And then the Red Sea goes all the way out to the Arabian Sea, and the Persian Gulf goes all the way out to the Arabian Sea. And then those, in turn, go out to the Indian Sea. But the Persian Gulf would be the first body of water, which in turn connects to the Arabian Sea, which in turn connects to the Indian Ocean. That forms the western boundary of ancient Persia. Persia is located in this entire area right here, which is off our map again. Let's see if I can maybe find a little bit better map here for you. We might not have a better one. No, that's it. Well, this is Persia right here, which is off our map. So just use your imagination right now. But this whole area right here would be ancient Persia. Does anyone know what country that would be today? You know what? Yeah. Yeah, it's Iran. That's right. It's modern Iran today. Of course, this is where much of the oil is shipped down through the Persian Gulf, which is a real hot spot today. That covers about 600 miles in length. I'm not sure how many square miles it would be. So it's fairly large in size. The second body of water would be the Caspian Sea. Maybe some of these I should write down on the board for you. The Caspian Sea. Caspian Sea, which covers about 169,000 square miles. Those are square miles now. I won't take the time to write that down. So the Caspian Sea is the largest inland body of salt water in the world. It's this sea right up here, about 169,000 square miles, about the size of Washington and Oregon, receives water from four rivers, but it does not have any outlet. That makes it very similar to the Dead Sea. It also forms a natural boundary in between Europe and Asia. So it's a natural boundary in that regard. Bordering the Caspian Sea on the south is the nation known today as Iran. Excuse me, Iraq. I take that back. It's Iraq would be on the south. Modern Iraq. And of course, Iraq and Iran are warring against each other even now. Then the third body of water would be the Black Sea. The Black Sea. This is north of Asia Minor, this sea right here. And again, it's off the map, but it's a very large body of water. In fact, as far as square miles is concerned, it's only 500 miles shy of the Caspian Sea. So they're almost exactly the same size. It's, to be technical here, 168,500 square miles. And again, it forms a natural boundary between Europe and Asia. And then number four would be the Mediterranean Ocean, or the Mediterranean Sea. Of course, that is the most famous of all classical seas of ancient antiquity, and this huge sea is called the Mediterranean Sea. Most important waterway of classical times. And when we talk about the Mediterranean Sea, we're talking about a body of water about 1,145,000 square miles. Very, very large body of water. Maximum length is about 2,300 miles in length, and the width would be about 1,200 miles. It borders Palestine, as you can see on the map, on the west. Palestine is facing north, and so it forms a western boundary. You'll often read about it in the Bible, and the Bible just simply calls it the sea or the Great Sea. And when the Bible just talks about the Great Sea, that's talking about the Mediterranean Sea. For example, Joshua chapter 1 and verse 4. Joshua 1:4, it talks about the Great Sea toward the going down of the sun. Well, then there's another little ocean that's not marked on our map here that I'm going to mention because you'll see it on various maps in the back of your Bible and so forth. It's this little one right here in between Asia Minor and Europe. This little sea right there is called Propontis. Propontis. And that's spelled P-R-O-P-O-N-T-I-S. Very small sea located between the Black Sea and what is often called the Aegean Sea, which borders Greece. Well then, number five, the fifth body of water, and we're kind of making a revolution here. We've got the Persian Sea, the Caspian Sea, the Black Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and this one right down here is called the Red Sea. The Red Sea. Sometimes the Red Sea is called the Arabian Gulf. The Arabian Gulf. It forms a natural division between Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. In other words, here's the Arabian Peninsula, which is mostly desert, and then you've got the Red Sea, and about the only way, at least by foot, that you could get to Africa from Arabia is to go up north along the Fertile Crescent and drop down through Palestine and go across north of the Red Sea. But other than that, there's a huge barrier and boundary right there. The Red Sea is about 1,500 miles long, and about 180 miles wide. So it, too, is quite large in size. 1,500 miles long, 180 miles wide. You'll notice it has two rabbit ears on it. We've got a better map of this. two different bodies of water on the northern portion of it. And so you can see them. This is the northern part of it. And on the right, you have the Gulf of Aqaba. And then on the left, the Gulf of Suez. And so, or you could say on the east is the Gulf of Aqaba. So that would be one here is Aqaba. And Aqaba is about 100 miles long in length, the Gulf of Aqaba. That's where Solomon built the town of Ezion Geber, and he had a little, little group of sailing vessels that he kept right there to sail off to the Indian Ocean. So that would be one part of the Red Sea. The other side, of course, is called the Gulf of Suez. The Gulf of Suez, this one right here. And that would be undoubtedly where Israel passed through. So somewhere probably on the northern portion of it. The Gulf of Suez. That's about 200 miles long. And today, of course, they have the Suez Canal built all the way to the Mediterranean Ocean, and ships canal sail from the Mediterranean Ocean all the way down to the Suez Canal, down to the Red Sea, and down into the Indian Ocean. So that's on the map. And if you look at the total size of Bible lands then, if you look at the whole heart of Bible lands on our map here, you'd find that really they are about 3/4 the size of the United States. That's excluding Alaska. If you looked at all of Persia, if you looked at Media, if you looked at Armenia up here to the north, and if you looked at ancient Palestine, and then if you looked at Egypt right here, we're talking about a landmass about 3/4 the size of the United States. Let's move on. Let's talk about another thought here. Let's talk about something called the Fertile Crescent. The Fertile Crescent. If you were to look on this map, and if it showed the vegetation on it, you'd notice that there was a horseshoe-shaped crescent. And it begins down here on the Persian Gulf, and then it follows what is called the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And it goes just like this. It makes a big arch. It makes a big loop like this, and then drops down into Palestine. And if you were to look at this map, this part is all just sand. It's all desert. There's no way you can cross from, let's say, Persia across Arabia over to the Red Sea. You'd have to follow the Fertile Crescent, because this area is just so barren and arid and just full of sand and desert. So it's a fertile green belt. Actually, it's about 1,000 miles from one side of it to the other side. So if you started right here and drew it, if you measured from here all the way over to the other leg, you'd find it's about 1,000 miles across from side to side. And the significant thing about the Fertile Crescent is that this is the route that the ancient caravans used to follow, and the ancient travelers and the merchants. For example, this is the route that Abraham followed in his trek from Ur of the Chaldees down into Palestine. You see, Abraham left this area right here, and he didn't just go across the desert. He would have never made it. And they would follow the Fertile Crescent, and they would go all the way up to the north and drop all the way down into Palestine. That's the route that Abraham took. And there's a real significant thing in connection to the history of Israel because of that, and that's this. Palestine became a doormat for all the conquerors of the world, because the first world government was actually Egypt. They were the strongest nation back like around 1600 BC and so forth. But there were later world kingdoms that desired to conquer Egypt. And so what did they do? To conquer them, for example, ancient Babylon and Assyria and Persia and Media and even Greece over here, what route did they take? The Fertile Crescent. And when they took that route, they came right through Palestine. So what did they do in their process of going down to Egypt? They conquered Palestine. And whenever they conquered various ancient empires, they conquered everyone along the way. So when you look at Israel, historically, all the ancient world governments actually conquered them and subjugated them, starting with Egypt. Egypt conquered them. Assyria conquered them. Babylon conquered them. Persia did. Greece did. And Rome did. And not so much because, you know, the Jews represented a great threat to them, but they just happened to be in the way. They were on the main highway, and so these different empires came down through them. And, of course, God used that to bring his people off into repentance. Now, also, you'll notice that Palestine just happens to be located on the southwest branch of the Fertile Crescent. So you draw the big loop like this and you come down, and at the very end of it is Palestine. Palestine is at the bottom of it. And that made Palestine a very, very pleasant land, particularly when you're talking about the surrounding lands. I mean, these Sirocco winds and so forth was blowing off this Arabian desert. It would be out here on this desert, it gets like 125 degrees out there. It gets to be 130 degrees or so. It gets extremely hot out there, but they were so close to the ocean, and they were so close to the mountains of Lebanon and Mount Hermon, and their exact geographical location is such that it was a very desirable spot, very beautiful spot, very fertile, very pleasant land, offered fertile soil, offered abundance of water, a mild climate, and surrounded with the sea and the mountains, and then, of course, the deserts were on the other side of it. So it was a real desirable location. In fact, there are two passages in the Old Testament. Jeremiah described the land of Palestine like this. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 19. Jeremiah 3:19. And Jeremiah said that Canaan was a goodly heritage, the most beautiful inheritance of the nations. So it was a very beautiful area. It's not like God gave them the scum of the earth. It's not like they got Edom or they got Moab or anything like that. It was a beautiful area. It was a desirable area. And then in Psalm chapter 106 and verse 24, Psalm 106 verse 24, the Bible talks about the pleasant land, talking about Palestine. The Hebrew is a land of desire. It was a land of desire. That's Psalm 106 and verse 24. So you see, it was a nice place to live, relatively speaking. I don't think it can compare to Montana. I don't think there's no comparison. And as far as I'm concerned, Montana is head and shoulders above Palestine any day. But the fact that I was shocked when I came to Bible college and found out that Montana was in the promised land. So I was sure it was. But I guess it's not. Then there are four major rivers. There are four major rivers in Bible lands that I'm going to mention. Four major rivers. Number one is the Tigris. The Tigris River. The Tigris River, which is about 1,150 miles in length. The Tigris River, spelled T-I-G-R-I-S. It begins in the highlands of Armenia, and there are two major rivers in the Fertile Crescent here, the Tigris and Euphrates. But the Tigris begins way up in the mountains of Armenia, up here where Mount Ararat is, where Noah landed, and of course the Ark did. In fact, Ararat's right there on the map for us. It begins in these high mountains, which are very high. I think Ararat is maybe 14,000 feet or something. It's about as high as we're near. And then it flows down off those mountains all the way down through for 1,000 miles into the Persian Gulf. That would be the Tigris River. And it does join the Euphrates River just shortly before it reaches the Persian Gulf. It's called the Hiddekel River. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 14, you can jot down that reference if you desire, and it'll give you the spelling of that. But in Genesis 2:14, when it talks about the Hiddekel River, that's the same as the Tigris. For many years, the ancient city of Nineveh was located on the shores or banks of the Tigris River, which was the capital of ancient Assyria. Then the second river is Euphrates. The second major river is the Euphrates River. Spelled like this, the Euphrates. This is a little bit longer river. It's approximately 1,675 miles in length. The Euphrates River, 1,675 miles long. It's first mentioned in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 14. Genesis 2:14. This one begins in what is called the Anti-Taurus mountain ranges. The Taurus mountains are right here located where Paul grew up at, and then on the other side, they're not marked on our map, are called the Anti-Taurus mountains, very high mountains again, and it is in the headwaters of these Anti-Taurus mountains that the river Euphrates begins and then flows for about 1,600 miles all the way down to the Fertile Crescent. Located on the river Euphrates is the ancient city of Babylon, and that, of course, became the capital city of ancient Babylon. So later on, that city started off as a city-state, and they called it Babylon, later developed into a vast empire that they called Babylon. And it joins, again, the Tigris River about 100 miles before it dumps into the Persian Gulf. It's often called in the Bible simply the river. When you read about the river in the Bible, or maybe the great river, it's often talking about the Euphrates River. The only other possibility would be the Nile River. Sometimes the Bible does call the Nile River just simply the river too. So you've got to look in the context to see which river it's talking about. For references with that, you can look at Exodus chapter 23 and verse 31 and Deuteronomy 1:7. Exodus 23:31 and Deuteronomy 1:7. The interesting thing is this, that I find, is that this is the original boundary that God gave to Abraham and God gave to David. God told Abraham and God told David that they were going to possess the land all the way over to the Euphrates River. And you see, they pretty much only occupy this little area of Palestine, but God really gave them all this land all the way over to the Euphrates River, which is a much, much larger expanse of land than what they're now occupying. In fact, Palestine today averages only about 150 miles from north to south and about 65 miles width, which is not very big. I mean, that's a very small piece of land. But someday, they're going to occupy this entire area of Syria and Lebanon, as well as ancient Babylon, which is Iraq today. And God has given them that. So you see, this is why the Jews and the Arabs have been arguing for so long, is because the Arabs claim the right to the land back through Abraham. And they say, well, God gave us this land through Abraham. And the Jews say, God gave us the land through Abraham. And they're going back and forth like this. And there's not going to be any real reconciliation until the King of Peace comes and reconciles the issue. But suffice it to say, it does belong to Israel, according to God, according to the Word of God. Then there's another river that's not too common. It's not too often heard about. It's not a very impressive river. It's called the Orontes. The Orontes River. I'll write it up here at the top. This would be the third one. It's only about, it's only about 250 miles in length. The Orontes, O-R-O-N-T-E-S. It has its source in Lebanon, right here in the Lebanese mountains, and then it actually flows north. Flows up north like this for about 250 miles, and then cuts over to the Mediterranean Sea. Probably the significant thing about it, there is a city called Antioch that was built on the shores of the Orontes River, and that's where Paul ministered from, the city of Antioch. And that is built on the Orontes River, just a small little river that flows like this, north of Palestine, up in Lebanon. And then number four, of course, is the Nile River. Notice we're not really mentioning the Jordan River. The Jordan is not that significant of a river. I think it's only, It's not very long in dimension. You know, it's something like maybe 75 or 100 miles in length is all. So we're not going to list that as a major river. But the Nile River flows about 4,000 miles north to the Mediterranean Sea, making it the longest river system in the world. Yes, 4,000 miles north into the Mediterranean Sea. And this would be the Nile River flowing down through the heart of Egypt, the main river of Egypt and Africa. In the King James Version, it's usually called the river, but it's never called the Nile in the Bible. It begins way down below the equator at an area called Lake Victoria, and of course it's the river which made Egyptian civilization possible. The ancient historians called Egypt the gift of the Nile, because without the Nile River, Egypt would not have been able to exist. It's surrounded by desert on both sides. It's a very barren area. If you were to look on a map that again showed the vegetation, you've got the Nile River, and then you've only got about maybe 10 to 20 miles of vegetation on either side of it, and then just bleak desert, and that's it.